Today is January the 24th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN-FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are slightly different. Based on the correspondence we receive, we find that there are many people listening to the show on demand or podcast than the regular program that is on the air on radio, so we will try to do something different. If you have a technical question or statement you want to make, send us a brief description of what you want to talk about along with your name, telephone number, and the day and time of the day we can call you, and we would then in turn play back telephone recordings of general interest for airing on the Personal Computer Show. In late breaking news, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, Qualcomm was slapped with a $1.23 billion fine by the European Union for illegal payments to Apple. Well, Apple negotiated with Qualcomm back in 2011 that rebate payments be received for target goals in use of Qualcomm chips. To get the best possible deal, Apple agreed to use Qualcomm baseband chips exclusively. By the way, they were the only ones that had it available. European Union says that this is an abuse of its dominant position by paying billions of dollars to Apple for chips exclusively. The European Union hit Qualcomm with this $1.23 billion antitrust fine today for illegal payments it made to Apple for exclusively using its chip in smartphones and other products. The decision itself, however, has no repercussion for Apple because the accusations don't center around any cartel. Apple eventually started sourcing some of its chips from Intel in the fall of 2016 when it became available, and this was shortly before the contract with Qualcomm was due to expire. Qualcomm strongly disagrees with this decision and would appeal to the European Union's second highest court. However, the way it's structured in Europe, the company still must comply with EU's decision regardless of the appeal. The European Union last summer fined Google $2.42 billion for abusing its dominance in its shopping service, and in 2016, it ordered Apple to pay $13 billion in alleged unpaid taxes to Ireland. Ireland says they don't owe those money, but the European Union says, yes, you do. Well, these companies are all appealing these decisions. However, as I said before, they could appeal it, but they must still comply with the European Union's decision. But before we get to the feature articles, let's get to what has been news during the past week. A bug that can cripple the iPhone with a single text message has been discovered, and the so-called text bomb can crash or restart a device upon receiving a text message containing a link to malicious code, and the victim doesn't even have to click on it to be affected. The bug also slows Safari browsers used to surf the internet on Macs, and it does drain battery levels. The security researcher who found this has reported to Apple, but Apple themselves have not commented on the matter and when it will be addressed. While the bug could be incredibly irritating if abused, it does not present a security risk to customers. Originally, AMD processors weren't affected by the Meltdown CPU flaw, and it was attributed only to Intel. However, researchers have discovered the methodology was adopted also in AMD. Microsoft's new patch solved the problem where it originally, when it was applied to AMD processors, caused a boot-up problem. The patch is called KB4073290 for AMD processors. Microsoft says it will either deploy this via Windows Update or, for those with the AMD processor, it can manually download it and do the update. Microsoft had done some investigation that some AMD chipsets, which they have not identified by model number, do not conform to the documentation previously provided to Microsoft to develop the Windows operating system. To prevent AMD customers from getting into an unbootable state, Microsoft will temporarily pause sending the following Windows operating system updates to devices which impacts AMD processors at this time. Microsoft didn't specify which AMD CPUs are vulnerable to the error. If your AMD PC refuses to boot after installing last week's emergency patch, Microsoft says its guides for troubleshooting blue screen errors in Windows 7, 8, and 10 may help. Actually, I had given the procedure on how you can get through the fix pretty easily last week, so if you can refer back to last week's broadcast, we'll get you through it. Even if you can't install the Meltdown patch at this time, you should upgrade your web browser immediately. The web browsers in question is Firefox, Chrome, Internet Explorer, and Edge, has all been updated with initial protection against Spectre CPU exploit, a separate issue from Meltdown and these flawed Windows patches. AMD chips are susceptible to Spectre. Also, be sure to keep your security software vigilant while you're working with the Windows patch. It won't be able to detect if the Meltdown or Spectre exploits are in conflict with the security software that you're using. This, by the way, has driven home, and it should have driven home to everyone, to regularly back up your PC. This has been a mantra that we've been asking everyone to follow up, and I guess by repeating it week after week by saying backup, 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 it sounds like it's something that you've heard before. You need not go through it. Really, take it to heart. Back up your system. If your data is backed up, it won't be the end of the world if a Windows update or a nasty bit of malware really cripples your system. And if you haven't done your backup, there's very little we can do to help you recover. There are things that I would buy locally if I could buy it at all. Things like small electronic parts, a diode here or a transistor there. I used to be able to buy it at a local electronics store. Of course, they're no longer available. I used to go to Lafayette Radio, Arrow Electronics, go down to Cortland Street where all the electronics stores were. Okay, so I wound up paying a little more when only Radio Shack was making the items available. Now, even that's not available anymore. With great reluctance, anything that costs, you know, $2, $3, you go mail order. And the mail order is like, the postage is $5, sometimes $10. And you say, there's got to be a different way of doing it. Well, I think that Amazon's finally figured out that items which are $10 and less, which are really small items, they're offering free shipping. That got my attention. Amazon has added a new $10 and under section to its app and website. And these items that cost $10 or cheaper will all have free shipping, whether or not you are a Prime membership. I give that a thumbs up. Mac computers running the latest version of Apple's High Sierra operating system have a flaw that just about let anyone unlock and edit a person's App Store preferences with any password. This vulnerability isn't as bad as the one that was found late November that allowed anyone to obtain higher administrative privileges on the Apple Mac computers merely by entering the username root, R-O-O-T, while logging into the user and group section of a Mac computer system preference menu. That earlier security hole has since been patched, of course, enabled anyone with physical access to a machine to view any files or change and reset any password for other users. The new flaw uncovered and posted on the OpenRadar site, it's a bug reporting website, is really indeed troubling. The finding so far is that it raises concern about Apple security design given that this is a second trivial login bug to come to light in just a few months. Apple has to do a better job of quality checking patches. Fortune successfully tested the bypass on a 2012 MacBook Pro running the latest version of Mac OS High Sierra. After unlocking the App Store preferences, a person can tweak a certain password settings, such as a frequency with which a system asks for a user's password when approving app-related purchases. Even so, attackers cannot go on prolonged spending sprees. The two options are always acquire or require after 15 minutes. One big caveat, though, anyone looking to take advantage of this authentication has to be logged in as an administrator. When Fortune tested the approach on a 2015 MacBook Air using a non-administrative account, all attempts did fail. Apple appears to be testing a patch for a bug in an early version of a coming macOS High Sierra upgrade 10.3.3. Look forward to it. It's malware, although some people say, no, it's not malware. It's helpful extensions for your browser, such as what is installed into Chrome and Firefox. Wouldn't it be nice if these malware authors make it easy to remove that dirty code? Sometimes all you have to do is open the control panel and uninstall the offending program, just like any other application. And for browsers, simply nuke the extension that is causing the problem. Unfortunately, some of the recent browser extensions for Chrome and Firefox are making things very difficult to remove, and they are very clever in hiding their whereabouts. The extension in question hijacked Chrome and Firefox to redirect web searches and drive up click counts on YouTube videos, presumably to generate ad revenue. Well, that in itself is not unusual, but it is frustrating that you can't just load up extension pages and delete them. They do this by closing up pages with extensions and add-on information, and they send information to users onto a different page altogether, such as an app overview pages where extensions do not appear. In Firefox, this problem is relatively easy to circumvent, but for Chrome, it takes a lot of digging, so much so that perhaps the fastest way to remove the problem is to report it to Chrome, and hopefully they can solve it for you. In my case, I don't use that many extensions, so I don't find it to be a problem at all. I just uninstalled the entire browser. I make sure it's completely uninstalled. I go into the program area and make sure that their subdirectory, which houses all that what we call mouse trails, is also removed, and it's gone. I try very hard not to include any extensions, but they sneak in in one form or another. One of the malicious extensions in Chrome is called Tiempo Un Colombia Un Vivo. It's not something that users will willingly install, but it essentially forces onto Chrome users when visiting certain websites. And blocking JavaScript doesn't help matters either, as it only applies to sites and not to Chrome's internal extensions page. As I said before, I just go ahead and just remove Chrome itself. And I got to tell you one thing. I have four different browsers installed on my system. I have Chrome, Firefox, obviously I have Edge, and Opera. What do I use most of the time? Opera. Why? Well, Firefox and Chrome seem to attract an awful lot of attention. They haven't done that to Opera, and Opera is very clean, and it runs very, it's pretty fast, and it also has a VPN built-in option. In Firefox, a malicious extension is called FF Helper Protection, and it works in a similar fashion by blocking the add-on page from loading. That means you can't remove it manually. However, what you can do is load Firefox in safe mode by holding down the Shift key when starting up the browser. Extensions are not loaded in safe mode, but you can see and remove them like normal. While the extensions have been around for a few weeks, both are still in use in one form or another. In fact, the Tiempo Un Colombia Un Vivo extension was still available in the Chrome Web Store at the time of this broadcast. Unfortunately, since both Chrome and Firefox extensions mostly add themselves through force installs, it's not always possible to avoid getting them. Your best bet is to avoid shady areas of the web, and if you still manage to get infected, one of the commentators point out that Piriform CCleaner has a browser plugin section that lets you disable and delete extensions, helps, toolbars, plugins, and all without having to open the browser.
You know, there used to be a comic strip, Black Hat, White Hat. Black Hat, of course, was the guy who committed all the evil stuff, the hacker that did all the bad stuff, and White Hat was all the good guys, also hacking around. At least, that's the impression you got. Well, what do you do when there's malware that's out there and it's government using it? Of course, they're using it for offense and not defense. And how are they doing it for offense? Well, it's a form of spying on other people. And it's reported that an Italian IT company has been using spoofed web pages to quietly distribute an extremely sophisticated Android spyware tool for conducting surveillance on targeted individuals since sometime in 2015. An advisory was put out by Aspersky Lab describing the tool named SkyGo Free as containing location-based audio equipment, audio recording capabilities, and other functionality that we've never seen in the wild. Available telemetry suggests that the multi-stage spyware was first developed in 2014 and has been in continuous use since then. The Android implant gives attackers the ability to take complete administrative control of infected devices and snoop in on conversations and nearby noises when the device enters specific locations. SkyGo Free is also designed to steal WhatsApp messages via Android's accessibility services and to connect infected devices to attacker-controlled Wi-Fi networks. Its other capabilities include the ability to take videos and pictures, steal call records and SMS messages, and grab geolocation data, calendar events, and other information from infected devices. Interestingly, the spyware too has been the ability to add itself to the list of protected Android apps on an infected device, so it doesn't go automatically get shut down when the screen is turned off. SkyGo Free supports 48 different commands that attackers can use to execute various malicious actions on an infected device. Attackers can control the malware using HTTP. This same IT firm that developed the malware also appears to be distributing it. The firm has been using web pages spoofed to appear like they belong to leading mobile network providers to develop the malware on Android devices. The first spoof landing pages were registered in 2015, and the most recent domain was registered last October, suggesting that the distribution campaign is still quite active. Based on the information, it was set up by the same commercial entity which is the belief behind the malware itself. Let's follow the registration records, and it suggests that the Italian firm is now trying to cover its track. By the way, I call it an Italian firm, but it could be spoofing it to be an Italian firm. It could be making like it's an Italian firm. It could be making like it's the Italian government. It may be nothing Italian at all. Available information shows that the targets of the attack so far have been all Italian-speaking individuals. What remains unclear is how exactly victims arrive at the spoofed landing pages from where the malware is being distributed. It could be some kind of malicious redirect or targeting phishing with a link. We don't know what it is. Identifying blocking high-end mobile malware such as SkyGo Free can be extremely challenging and very difficult. Another big challenge is the relatively small numbers of people that can get targeted, with this kind of tool making it hard for security researchers to get their hands on them. Kaspersky Lab has not identified the developer of SkyGo Free by the name, but the IT firm behind the spyware appears to be similar to the other providers of so-called lawful intercept software. It seems that it was originally designed for governments to be using or legal entities are using. How malicious or how dangerous is this? Well, it requires the availability of 5 vulnerabilities for it to be effective. That seems like it's really targeting selected devices or manufacturers. you got to remember that it wasn't all that long ago we were reporting that Samsung TVs, the smart TVs, you had to cover up that camera because the sound, the video was spying on whoever the users were, even when the TV was not on. This one looks like it's manufacturer targeted. This sounds more like industrial spying.
Apple will open a new campus as part of a 5-year, $30 billion U.S. investment plan and will make $38 billion in a one-time tax payment on its overseas cash, one of the largest corporate spending plans announced since the passage of the tax cut. The company has been under increasing pressure to make U.S. investments. While Apple has announced no plans to change that practice, an expert says it would be economically impractical to make iPhones in the United States. The company, however, intends to spend $350 billion in the United States over the next 5 years, hire 20,000 people, and make the tax payment as required to get the money back from overseas. It did not, however, say how much of the plan was new or how much of its $252 billion, that's $250 billion, in cash overbroad, the largest of any U.S. corporation, it would bring home. Well, since they announced $38 billion, they're bringing everything back home. In addition to the $38 billion in taxes it must pay, Apple has run up $97 billion in U.S.-issued debt to pay for previous share buyback and dividends. So a lot of that money is going to be paying off that $97 billion that they borrowed. Some investors said the U.S. investments would give the company room to make stock buybacks or pay dividends without criticism. Reuters had estimated that Apple could have increased U.S. headcount by 24,000 in the last 5 years. Tim Cook has said, "Let me be clear, there are large part of this that are a result of the tax reform, and there's large part of this we could have done in any situation." About a third of Apple's new spending will be on data centers to house its iCloud, App Store, and Apple Music services. It's a major increase in importance in the subscription services to a company known for its computers and gadgets. Apple also has data centers in 7 states. The announced U.S. spending will be a significant part of Apple's overall capital expenditures. If Apple overall capital expenditures continue to expand at the same rate to this expected this year, the $30 billion investment in the United States could represent about a third of its capital expenditure over the next 5 years. The tax bill requires companies to pay a one-time 15.5% tax on foreign-held earnings, whether they intend to bring it back to the United States or not. Apple had set aside $36.3 billion in anticipation of tax payments on its foreign cash, meaning the payment would not represent a major impact on its cash flow of this quarter. Apple also said it would boost its advanced manufacturing fund used to provide capital and support to its suppliers, and it planned to spend $55 billion with U.S.-based suppliers in 2018, up from $50 billion last year. They plan on a new campus, and unlike Amazon, where there is a frenzy bidding for Amazon to open a new center, Apple will just decide where they're going to want it without going through the bidding frenzy. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel told reporters, "They're going to go out and compete, and we're going to put our best foot forward to compete for an Apple campus." However, the Philadelphia Department of Commerce spokeswoman said the city will submit a proposal and they hope that Apple will open the process for bids. Apple has not said whether it's settled on a new campus location yet. This new campus will house technical support for customers and they will announce the location later this year. The facility is in addition to the spaceship Apple Park headquarters in Cupertino and a campus in Austin, Texas, that houses customer service agents and some manufacturing, and they have several thousand customer service agents and iPhones refurbishing technicians. Apple also has built its own data centers in North Carolina, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, and a recently announced project in Iowa. Tim Cook has said that the reason for moving foreign money back to the United States is we want to help America. He also said that Apple never thought that the old system was good for the United States because it kept money overseas and motivated people to invest elsewhere instead of within the country. Apple officials have always viewed that the company could only have been started in America and that they feel a responsibility to give back. One way of doing that is to create jobs, he said. Tim Cook said that we are probably the only company of our size where every person is an owner in the company. That's because they're giving out a $2,500 restricted stock grant to each employee. That makes everyone an owner in the company. One of the things that been sort of like under the radar that Apple's doing that is really, that should be noted, is that they will be matching employees' charitable donations 2-to-1. He said that there are many, many happy employees now since the announcement was made. Well, it's nice to hear that although we call it a tax cut reform, it's brought back a lot of smiling faces. It's great to have that this tax reform is bringing back jobs, bringing money back home. But you know what it all comes down to? The whole thing was about money. In the end, isn't that what it really is? Apple has announced that the next update to iOS 11 will allow users to disable battery performance throttling on their device. The update will more clearly inform users when their iPhone is automatically reducing its performance in an effort to prevent unexpected shutdown. If you don't want it, you can turn it off. The next iOS 11 developers beta is expected in early February, which means a public release will follow sometime in March. For tonight, we have a number of interesting feature segments. Dr. Alfred Poor with Wearable and Health Technologies will be talking about smartphone app that diagnoses coughs, a device that can help prevent migraines without pills, and augmented reality glasses help a blind high school student see. I, in turn, from the tech corner, I'm going to be talking about artificial intelligence, and just remember, it's artificial and it is vulnerable. And Marty Winston will be covering home automation, where he talks about how do you go about correcting bad experiences.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
I'm a lucky guy. I'm a lucky guy for a lot of reasons, but there's one in particular that I'm thinking of tonight, and that is a lot of people have been really sick this winter. Lots of colds and upper respiratory infections and coughs. I know people who've had coughs that have lingered for a month or more, and I feel very fortunate that so far I've more or less managed to avoid most of that. But one of the problems with these coughs is that how do you know whether it's something serious or not? Going to the doctor to have them listen to your cough seems a little extreme, but for many people, you know, that's the only option. Well, there's a company in Australia that's working on a different approach. It's really very simple. You just cough and record the sounds of your cough with your smartphone, and it analyzes the sounds and it can diagnose the kind of cough that you have and what the disease is that's behind it. So it can tell the difference between asthma and pneumonia or, you know, other kinds of cough symptoms that you might have. The company's called ResApp, R-E-S-A-P-P. They started off with this for children, a pediatric project, but now they're branching out and they're trying to do clinical tests to discover whether or not it works well for adults as well. And they released the results of one recent clinical trial that they did, and they found that the results were about 90% in agreement with what physicians diagnosed the patient with. So that's pretty accurate, 90%. Couldn't be more convenient. So you record your sounds with the smartphone, and it analyzes your coughing sounds and comes up with a diagnosis. Now, it's not available yet in this country. They're still doing lots more trials, but it's a very promising technology and could save people a lot of time and a lot of trips to the doctor. Another reason I'm lucky is that I don't get migraine headaches. My dad did, my daughter does, and it's just no fun. Extremely painful, can be debilitating. It's very hard to treat effectively. Some people I know with migraines actually have to go to the hospital to get medications and to get treatment so that, you know, to help them deal with the pain. In this country, you know, we're all dealing with the problem of the opioid epidemic and use, abuse of drugs. There's a lot of interest in non-pharmacological solutions to pain. And there's a company called Cefaly. I think I'm pronouncing that's right. It's Cefaly. They have a product that's been FDA approved to help patients deal with the pain of migraines. And in fact, on average, it reduces pain by 65%. Also, almost a third of the patients who use it are pain-free within an hour. Now, the news is they've now received additional approval for another device that not only can help deal with the pain of a migraine, it can actually prevent a migraine from occurring. If a patient feels that a migraine might be coming on, different patients have different sensations that indicate that a migraine might be about to start. Some see an aura, some have other feelings. But in any case, if you use this device repeatedly, it can help reduce the occurrence of migraine headaches. This is an incredible piece of news. It's only available through prescription, so you have to see your doctor about it. But if it works as advertised and as the studies show, this could provide an enormous amount of relief to migraine sufferers. I'm going to end with the feel-good story of the evening. Let me take you back a few years to when Google Glass came out. Everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people had negative reactions to it, didn't know what it was for, and thought they looked goofy and they were really expensive. And as a result, people have been saying Google Glass is dead, which isn't the case, that they're still working on developing the product. But the fact is that augmented reality glasses already are widely used in industry at the enterprise level, a great productivity boost. And we're going to see them more and more in personal lives. Well, the feel-good story comes from a company called Vuzix, and they make smart glasses largely for the industrial applications that I mentioned. But they heard about a high school student in Pennsylvania, and she was born with a vision impairment. And so she can't see very well. She has to bring things way up close to her eye in order to be able to see something. And it makes it very difficult for her to read. It's difficult for her to see what's going on in the classroom. Her school district did their best to help. They would create camera and monitor installations in some of the classrooms so that she could follow along what was going on. But they could only equip a couple classrooms, and it didn't work all that well. And so it was a problem. And when she wasn't in those classrooms, you know, she didn't have the help. Well, Vuzix heard about her and gave her a pair of smart glasses. It allows her to see better through the glasses. It can enlarge what she's looking at. It can have automatic object and color recognition. It can even read text aloud to her when she sees it. And she also can use it to scan barcodes to help her identify products that she's looking at. There's even a feature in the program that will tell her what the other person's moods are through facial recognition technology. So this has helped her lead a far more normal life. It's augmented her vision to the point where it's very helpful, and it's lightweight, portable, mobile. It's on her head, goes with her everywhere she goes, and it helps her see. So this is just one example of how wearable technology can adapt to help people with impairments such as vision and can make their lives better. Before I go, there's one more thing I want to mention. As you know, I was at CES 2018 in Las Vegas earlier in January, and I'm going to be putting on a free webinar providing an executive summary of the major themes that I saw at the show and covering a bunch of the different products that I thought were of particular interest. You'll be able to find out more about this at the website, healthtechinsider.com, where you'll be able to register for free. So watch for that on the website, the free webinar. It's going to be held on Thursday, February 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern. That's Thursday, February 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern time. So if you're interested, hope you can make it, and look forward to seeing you at the webinar. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com.
This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
I remembered when I was going to school, there was a novel that was released, and the title of it was 1984. Well, that was back in 1948. George Orwell is the author of that now famous novel. And I just thought that, well, that's such a long time away. And when I read the contents of it, I said, that's spying, Big Brother's watching, there's cameras everywhere. That's not going to happen. Well, as you know, it's happened. We have all these ATM machines, and every business now have video cameras to record things so that when there are liability suits, whether someone fell or someone, you know, if they did something and something happened and there's an accident, there's a record of it. And in a way, that's good. The bad part is, everywhere you go outside of your house is recorded. Then, back in 2002, a movie came out. And Tom Cruise was a star in that movie, and the title of the film was The Minority Report. Now I thought that was really getting to a point where we are now over the top. And what do I mean by that? What it is about is a movie that they are using computers to predict your behavior before you have done anything. In other words, they're saying that based on all the information they have collected, they know that you will be a criminal, and if you're going to be a criminal, they will then mete out the punishment or actually incarcerate you, because not that you've done anything wrong, but the computer's algorithm says you will be a criminal. Now, I think that's really just pushing the use of artificial intelligence way, way to the extreme where we're accepting it, and I said, that's not going to happen. And unfortunately, I'm reading that we are doing that now. Well, artificial intelligence, remember the word artificial, that's it, artificial. These algorithms are developed by the human being. And with all these vulnerabilities we hear, with all the hacking, with all the insecurity that we have because of the data itself is not secure or properly encrypted, what makes you think that someone can not just manipulate that data? I mean, we already heard that when the president's health was reported, we had doctors without examining the president says they know he either has a heart attack or he has a heart disease or he has cancer. And how do they know? Well, they are doctors, and some of them who came out publicly are famous. Well, let's say they are well known in the public. That's speculative. Speculative means that it hasn't happened, but you're saying it's going to happen. And therefore, we have to do something before it happens. That's where I get to a point of saying, enough of this artificial intelligence. We have to be using our common sense. And what am I referring to? Software that predicts how likely a criminal will re-offend, which means you can offend. It's being used by the courts now to mete out punishments. What I mean now is that software that predicts how likely a criminal will offend or re-offend, and it's presently used by the courts to mete out punishments, and it's about as smart as a layperson off the street. According to a paper published in Science and Advances, the research highlights the potential dangers of relying on black box algorithms, particularly when a person's freedom is at stake. The software in question is called COMPAS, COMPAS, which stands for Correctional Offender Management Profiling for Alternative Sanctions. It was designed by Equivant, E-Q-U-I-V-A-N, which was previously known as North Point. That's P-O-I-N-T-E, and that's one word, North Point. And I spelled this out so that if you want to do more research on this product, you will probably agree with me it's probably as objectionable as the whole concept itself. The software provides technological solutions for court systems across America. What that means is it takes in a load of information about defendants and produces reports that predict their unlawfulness or lawfulness. And trial judges are asked to use that to guide them in sentencing. Well, people condemned by the code to be future repeat offenders are put behind bars for a longer period or sent on special courses And, well, as you can see, it goes on and on. The way Compass works internally is unclear since its maker doesn't want to give away its algorithm, or what they call their trade secrets or commercial secrets. It's a complex tool that, according to study researchers, takes into account 137 variables when deciding how likely a defendant will reoffend within 2 years of their most recent crime. Hey, how do we know that 137 is just the right number of variables? Maybe there's a lot more. Maybe should be a lot less. No one, no authority has even written off and certified that this is correct. It has assessed more than 1 million lawbreakers since it was deployed at the turn of the millennium. In other words, this tool has been in use for a good 15 to 18 years. However, according to published research, because now that it's been in use such a long time, they have some cases that they can refer to see how accurate it is. The application has the same level of accuracy as untrained people pulled off the street, armed with only 7 of the variables. In fact, those 7 variables, matching up to the 137, they came up with the same results and were just as accurate as Compass when the people were given just 2 bits of information, a defendant's age and the number of prior convictions. In other words, if you took someone with no legal or psychological or criminal justice system training, you probably will, given a few bits of information, come up with the same results as the software. According to the study, which was led by a software engineer from Dartmouth College, they collected records on 1,000 defendants and randomly divided the dataset into 20 groups of 50 people each. Then human participants were recruited to complete the mundane task, and each participant was assigned to one of these 20 subsets. These 20 non-experts, human judges, were given really just basic information on the defendant and whatever that is normally available in the public. Each person was asked, "Do you think this person will commit another crime within 2 years?" They then had to respond by selecting simple answer, yes or no. Variables that was commented on, that they were given, is much less information than going on 137 apparent variables from the Compass software. Despite this, the human team was accurate in 67% of the cases, while the software was only accurate in 65.2% of the cases. Why do we need the program? And why are we relying on this program, which is only two-thirds accurate, actually less than two-thirds accurate, and that they call artificial intelligence? Compass predictions can have a profound impact on someone's life, so this software needs to be held to a much higher standard. It's essential that it at least outperforms human judgment. Advances in AI are very promising, but this is not the time to use it in the real situation. We think it's important to step back and understand that these algorithms work and how they compare against human decision-making before we start entrusting such serious decisions to a machine. Black defendants are more likely to be classified as medium or high risk by Compass because black defendants are more likely to have prior arrests. So that's one of the criteria. Hey, that should not be one of the criteria. On the other hand, while defendants are more likely to be classified as low risk by Compass because white defendants are less likely to have prior arrests. Therefore, black defendants who don't reoffend are predicted to be riskier than white defendants. It's time we examine the tools we use and not take it for granted because it is on a computer. It must be correct.
I tend to put a lot of focus in my segments here on the electronics of our cybernetic house project. But really, well, sure, the cybernetics help to reduce the number of human chores. The truth is that in this project, being lazy comes second to being a cheapskate. The cybernetics primarily help keep the design energy miserly and help meet our goal of being 40 years maintenance-free, meaning 4 decades of dodging the expense and bother of major repair or replacement issues. And people keep asking me how it's even remotely possible to figure out either one of those. So here's my attempt to answer that. To be sure, there's a ton of homework involved, reading up on published tech specs, until you can figure out who's lying, who's exaggerating, who's guessing, and who's worth trusting. I've put in hundreds of days investigating at trade shows with field experts and so on, and hundreds of hours of phone interviews with top execs and top technical people in the companies that build these products, asking how and why they made the choices they did, and what they know is coming that might even better meet our needs. That's tons of homework. And speaking of homework, I should tip my hat in the direction of Ray Malberg, who may no longer be with us, who was my physics teacher in 10th grade and chemistry teacher in 11th grade, because what he helped me learn then has proven to be a bulwark in figuring things out now, like the ways structural shifts impact energy exchanges, and in figuring out where to direct our sensors and how tightly to deploy them to be able to go beyond measurement and into inference, which is a perfect pairing for a cybernetic network. Those are mostly good things. But as I tell my kids, you only ever really learn from your bruises, or as you attain wisdom from other people's bruises. So let me lean slightly Pollyanna and say this. We've had the good fortune of living in some terrible rented houses. The one we're in now is, as just one example, the one we're in now as we work through our project house build, we'll need 2 weeks of professional attention to its ductwork in order to reattach insulation and repair gaps. And until that happens, all of the HVAC impact is in a small lavatory next to the kitchen near the outdoor HVAC system unit. And who thought it would be a good idea to place a lavatory next to a kitchen? For future reference, that idea stinks. The ventilation in the house is so bad that year-round, our energy costs are, give or take, $200 a month more than our neighbors. The sewer drain lines don't meet code, so sinks drain slowly or back up. The electrical doesn't meet code, so there are switches that don't operate anything, lights that we have no way to turn on or off, and places that are trying to accomplish a four-way switch arrangement with two-way or three-way switches. That's not going to be possible, is it? The house before this one had insulation just half a tick better than corrugated cardboard, an undersized HVAC system, undersized ducts, and drain lines that had been graded to level, meaning 5 to 6 backups per year. The houses before that, more of the same, plus gappy window frames, untraceable septic system, aromatherapy, a leaking roof, mold, and worse. Those were the tunnel of tuition years, which didn't leave us enough monetary financial bandwidth to cope with the idea of expunging all of those sins all at once. That resolve is much more recent and just a few years old. We now know a lot more about our structural expectations for, well, we'll call it a happy house. It needs an insulated basement or crawl space, treated before and after the concrete pour, to discourage unwelcome insects, especially termites, and with a water barrier separating it from water flows in the surrounding soil. The envelope of the house needs to be structural insulated panels. That's a sandwich of inside and outside flatboard sheets, an engineered OSB or oriented strand board, with solid foam between them, and humidity transfer blocking added for good measure. Humidity transfer blocking means when it's humid outside, it won't come in. When it's humid inside, or at least we get the moisture where it should be in dry weather, it won't leak out. The roof needs to be metal over bracing strips, over outward-facing heat-reflecting foil, over a liquid and vapor moisture barrier, over roofing board, engineered again, over engineered lumber trusses with high-density foam between the trusses on the underside of the roofing board. That makes for a conditioned attic space. The ventilation ducts are round, not rectangular, to allow fewer perturbations within the airflow, double-walled as one step in reducing energy loss, but also taped and insulation jacketed all the way through to the boots at the vent registers. Almost all of the electrical switches are virtual, meaning they only handle low signal level voltages and currents. All AC outlet locations will offer at least 4 outlets, meaning 2 duplex outlets side by side in a 2-gang electrical box. All the breakers and wiring are 20 amp. The plumbing connections are Viga PEX pipe run through double-walled duct, clustering hot lines together and cold lines together. from the point of use to a master distribution mana block. Mana block is sort of the water version of what an electrical breaker box does. So we're designing a structure to escape all those flaws, all those terrible rented house idiosyncrasies, and integrating thousands of sensors to let automation keep an eye on everything, providing the earliest possible notification of small things that may need our attention before turning into big things. And while we may be designing our next attribute into the power and data elements of our electronics, the one thing we never want the drains to do is to back up, back up, back up. Plunge on to the rest of the show, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the Northeast Regional Tri-State Area. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on current trends in personal technology Thursday, January the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Bitcoin Thursday, February the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, February the 2nd, 8 p.m., at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bardo Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, February the 6th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on, my favorite topic, backing up your computer, Tuesday, February the 6th, 1:30 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, February the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be having their meeting Friday, February the 9th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of Harry J. Scherer Hall. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. These meetings are all open to the public, free to attend, and we're looking forward to seeing you there. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, you need to back up. Make sure you back up your files. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and till we meet again, same time, same station next week.